is a distinct pleasure to present to you some results of the project I am pursuing at the KGF. I would like to thank the directors for hosting me in this stimulating community, and all of you for being here today. And in particular, I would like to thank Philipp Winkler for posing a question to me that was fundamental for my investigation. So Jerusalem, July the 15th, Anno Domini 1099. After a siege that lasted 1.5 months, the Crusader army succeeded in breaking through the northern wall of the city, and the contingent led by the Norman prince Tancred chased the Muslim defenders up to Mount Moriah to the east. Tancred's biographer Raoul of Caen, in his Gesta Tancredi in Expedizione Hierosolimitana, Tancred's deeds in the expedition to Jerusalem, written in 1114, recounts that once on the Curia Templorum, the courtyard of the temples, Tancred, reaching for the enemies who had taken refuge in the Templum Salomonis, the Temple of Solomon, entered the Templum Domini, the Temple of the Lord, and was astonished by what he saw, which is described as follows. There was a cast statue on a high-placed throne. It was a heavy silver statue, which 6 strong right arms could hardly carry, which 10 right arms could hardly raise. When Tancred sees it from a distance, he says, "For shame, what does this image before me mean? What does this high-placed, imposing image mean? What does this depiction mean? What do the gemstones mean? What does gold mean? What does purple mean?" In fact, it was Muhammad, bound all over with gemstones and purple, and it shone because of the gold. Perhaps this is the statue of Mars or of Apollo, or maybe Christ. Here there are not the signs of Christ, not the cross, not the crown, not the nails, not the drain side. Therefore, this is not Christ, but the very first Antichrist, the depraved Muhammad, the ruinous Muhammad. If his companion were here now, he would already be mine. My foot would press down and kill both Antichrists. Where is Tancredi? And where does he see the statue of Muhammad? Curia Templorum, the courtyard of the temples on Mount Moriah, unequivocally refers here to the Haram al-Sharif, the noble precinct, that is still today a sacred enclave for Muslims and encloses Al-Aqsa Mosque to the south, the Dome of the Rock almost in the middle, and several minor holy shrines. The area has a long history of sacredness and architectural continuity that is worth recalling. The Haram is located in the area where the first Jewish temple once was, the holy house Beit HaMikdash for the God of Israel, built by Solomon in the 10th century before Christ. Its inner and most sacred part, the Devir, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant stood and God dwelled, was located on the foundation stone upon which God had accomplished the creation, which is the rock that is today encapsulated in the Dome of the Rock. Solomon's temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 and then rebuilt after the Babylonian exile at the beginning of the 6th century. The second temple was desecrated by Antiochus IV, Philopator, and soon restored by the Maccabees in the 2nd century BC. Then, later on, in 1920 BC, Herod the Great substituted the structure with a large and lavish complex that stood on a trapezoidal esplanade, at the center of which was the rock, always enclosed in the Holy of Holies of the temple, where only the high priest could enter. In 70 CE, the Roman Emperor Titus conquered the Judea, besieged Jerusalem, and razed the temple, spoiling it of its treasures and expelled the Jews from the holy city. Jerusalem was then abandoned for almost 60 years until Emperor Hadrian, in 132 circa, decided to establish a colony there for the Decima Legio Fratensis. The building activity also involved the Temple Mount, where he set the Capitolium, the complex of political and religious structures that also included the temple devoted to Jupiter Capitolinus. The Jews reacted to the desecration of the area with a revolt led by Shimeon Bar Kokhba, who during his short rule attempted to restore the temple. But the revolt was repressed, the Jews were expelled from Jerusalem, and the temple area was gradually abandoned. Indeed, in the meanwhile, the city started to assume a Christian topography that culminated under Constantine in 325-326 circa, after the construction of the Basilica of the Anastasis, the new temple of the new Israel. Except for an attempt to restore the Jewish temple attributed to Emperor Julian in 361-363, Mount Moriah became a dung heap where only some Jews went to anoint the rock on the night of Av, the day of the destruction of the first and the second temple. It was only after the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem in 636 that Mount Moriah reacquired its status as the holiest place in the city. According to Muslim and Christian sources, as soon as the second rightly guided caliph, Omar ibn al-Khattab, the conqueror of Jerusalem, entered the city, he asked to be shown around the temple area and cleansed the rock by himself, thus establishing a place for prayer on the southern wall of the Herodian Esplanade. Later on, probably only under the first Umayyad caliph, Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, 661-680, the building activity was extended to the entire temple area, which thus took shape as the Haram al-Sharif, an outdoor mosque whose covered part indicating the Qibla, the direction of prayer, was constituted by Al-Aqsa Mosque, completed in 750 by Caliph al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik, to substitute the building constructed by Omar. It was destroyed by an earthquake in 746 and then rebuilt and destroyed once again by an earthquake in 1015 and another in 1033. After this date, Al-Aqsa acquired its present-day shape. However, the center of the sacred area was occupied by the Dome of the Rock. The shrine that encapsulates the rock where the Devir of Solomon's temple stood, and it was completed in 691-92 under the Caliph Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan. This shrine is a very enigmatic building, since it is neither a mosque nor a memorial, and its original meaning is not univocally recognized by Muslim sources or modern scholars. Its shape, an octagonal structure accessible through four doors, contains two concentric octagonal ambulatories separated by columns and piers, and is surmounted by a dome set on a high drum. This structure recalls the late antique architectonic type of the Martyria, with a round plan to which the Constantinian Basilica of the Holy Sepulchre, the Rotunda, also belonged, but there are no similar examples in Muslim architecture. Its inner decoration, partly preserved, consisted of marble, gilt bronze plaques, and mosaics displaying royal insignia, flowers and plants, and an inscription running all along the perimeter of the inner and outer octagonal arcade that proclaims Islam as the last divine law, the oneness of God, the mission of Muhammad as his final messenger, the status of Jesus as a man and a prophet, and remember Abd al-Malik, later replaced by the name of al-Ma'mun, as the builder of the sanctuary. By analyzing historical and artistic facts, Oleg Grabar has suggested that the Dome of the Rock had the major political and religious function of legitimizing the power of the Umayyad dynasty through Davidic reminiscence and of proclaiming the triumph of Islam over the defeated empires and Christianity. Moreover, it is located in front of the Basilica of the Holy Sepulchre, and you can see the cupola here. And overwhelms it with its higher position and more lavish appearance. However, other scholars have posed the question of whether the shrine could be a reproposition of the Temple of Solomon, since the decorative program also shows some elements that can be linked to the first temple, which was also evoked in the ritual of the dedication of the building performed by Abd al-Malik and the service he established there. This landscape is complicated by the pilgrimage practice and its relationship with Mecca, the progressive association of the site with the Prophet's night journey, which culminated in the Fatimid period, and the further recuperation of Jewish traditions concerning the topography of the Final Judgment. The question is very complicated, but we will leave it here and instead turn to Christian sources to understand how the Crusaders perceived and reacted to the Haram when they found it on Mount Moriah. Latin pilgrimage narratives written between the 7th and the 9th centuries present a shift from the identification of the site as the place where the Temple of Solomon once stood and where the Saracens had built a house of prayer, to the identification of the whole Haram as the Temple of Solomon, where a synagogue of the Saracens was located. And this is the description by Bernardus Monachus. A further step is found in the anonymous Qualiter Sita Est Civitas Hierosolimitana, how the city of Jerusalem is located. In this text, written between 1095 and 1103 circa, the buildings on Mount Moriah are described as follows. Then at east is the beautiful door that leads to the Temple of the Lord. This temple is rounded, has four doors, and is surrounded by a wonderful courtyard. Inside the temple is a temple not made by human hands. This is the tabernacle where people think Aaron's robe, the head of Zechariah, son of Barakiah, and the altar that Jacob built for the Lord, and the two tables of the law, and the Ark of the Covenant, and the manna that nourished the children of Israel in the desert are hidden. From the ceiling of the temple hangs a golden lamp. To the south of the temple is the Temple of Solomon. From this description, it clearly emerges that the Templum Domini, rounded with four doors and in the middle of the courtyard, is the Dome of the Rock, while the Templum Salomonis, located to the south in the same courtyard, is Al-Aqsa Mosque. This identification of the Muslim shrines is also found in other pilgrimage narratives of narratives and Crusader chronicles, in the so-called Crusader maps of Jerusalem, of which this is an example, and is supported by archaeological evidences. Indeed, the Dome of the Rock, renamed Templum Domini, which you can see here, was converted into a church dedicated to the Virgin Mary soon after the Crusader conquest, while Al-Aqsa, renamed the Templum or Palatium Salomonis, which is here, became the see of the Latin kings of Jerusalem and later that of the Knights of the Order of the Temple. The Christian appropriation of the buildings and their conversion into a church and the center of the royal power of the new established Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem responds to a polemical intent. Through the recuperation of its veterotestamentary past and the dedication to the Mother of God, the mystical Templum Domini, Temple of the Lord, the message carried by the Dome of the Rock was converted into a counter-proclamation of the triumph of Christianity over Islam, while the correlated counter-proclamation of the military and political victory was entrusted to Al-Aqsa, which was spoiled of its sacredness and status as an imperial mosque and endowed with a political and representative function. However, this pragmatic and polemical approach to the haram and the obliteration of the Muslim history of the Temple Mount, achieved through the biblical memories linked to the site, is also associated with a psychological and religious phenomenon known as sacred topography. This attitude characterizes Christian descriptions and pilgrimage itineraries to the Holy Land and consists of actualizing the biblical past and accordingly reshaping and reinterpreting the spaces where the events of the sacred history took place, regardless of the history and present conditions. It is in this perspective that the Anonymous of the Qualiter Sita registers on Mount Moriah the presence of a building that was destroyed in 586 before Christ and locates in it the tabernacle preserving the Ark of the Covenant and other relics that had been spoiled by Nebuchadnezzar and carried to Babylon. Thus, the Dome of the Rock, standing where the ancient temple had stood, containing the rock where the Holy of Holies was once located, and being an astonishing and impressive building, could be easily identified as Solomon's temple, regardless of its recent past. Now, having clarified the situation regarding the history of Mount Moriah and the Christian perception and representation of the Dome of the Rock as the temple built by Solomon, we can return to Raoul's text, who states that Tancred found a statue there of the Antichrist Muhammad. Thus, we have three problems to solve. The first, did Tancred really see a statue of Muhammad in the Dome of the Rock? The second, why does Raoul locate the statue in the Dome of the Rock? And the third, why is Muhammad identified as the first Antichrist? As far as the first question is concerned, we can recall that although portraits of the prophet are found in manuscript illuminations and even mural paintings, there is no evidence of a statue displaying his features placed in the Dome of the Rock or in any other Muslim shrine. Moreover, the aversion of Islam towards iconic representations of the divine is well known, and in any case, Muhammad has never been worshipped as a god by Muslims, since he is recognized as a messenger of God, the last of the prophets, and to have an absolutely human nature. Thus, it is impossible that the statue of the prophet was found in the Dome of the Rock in 1099. Ksenia Muratova, who erroneously locates the episode narrated by Raoul in the Templum Salomonis Al-Aqsa Mosque, has hypothesized that the statue seen by Tancred refers to the presence, or to a legend concerning the presence, of a statue of Jupiter Capitolinus on the Temple Mount that should have still been vivid in the 11th century. She relies on the description of two statues of Adrian seen by the pilgrim of Bordeaux and two statues of Jupiter and Adrian referred to by Jerome in his commentary on the book of Isaiah and on the Gospel of Matthew as standing in the temple area. Both authors wrote in the 4th century. However, this hypothesis is quite unlikely since it is unthinkable that the statue of a pagan deity could find a place in an area sacred to the strictly monotheistic cult of Allah, and that the description of the statues of Adrian and Jupiter found in late antique texts could be reproposed in an 11th century writing issued by a witness to the event, as Raoul was. Another explanation has been proposed by other scholars, who interpret the statue of Muhammad as representing Islam as a pagan, idolatrous religion, which would express the ignorance of Western Christians about the Muslim religion or the ideological propagandistic aim of justifying the armed liberation of the Holy Land. Representations of Muslims as pagan idolaters are actually found in the Chanson de Geste. But this is a very different genre from historiographical works, such as the Gesta Tancredi. Indeed, in the clash between Christians and Saracens narrated in the Chanson de Geste, the latter represent old non-Christian peoples whose religion conflates ancient paganism, Islam, and also Judaism in a pantheon of deities, among which Muhammad is only one of the several gods. This happens according to a literary convention that relies on ancient epic models, like the Homeric poems or the Aeneid and the Pharsalia, and according to narrative purposes held by scenes of the adoration of gods represented by idols. Indeed, the Chanson de Geste, along with focusing on the celebration of the moral and religious superiority of Christianity all over other past and present beliefs, also aim to entertain the audience, and in such a context, exoticism, such as idolatrous rituals, plays an important role. Historiographical texts, instead, when dealing with Islam, show a different approach. Through Muhammad's biography, historiographers aim at revealing the truth about the deceptive nature of his religion, and often rely on Muslim sources. Indeed, the life and deeds of the Prophet, so far from Christian geographical models and ethical behavior, were sufficient per se to shock the audience, question his prophetical status, and interpret his role within the history of salvation. Therefore, the discourse on the idolatry of the Saracens is not sustainable, either in the case of the Gesta Tancredi. But there is a third explanation for the presence of the statue, and it comes from the text itself. If we go back to it, we can see that when Tancred enters the building and faces the statue, his first reaction is to wonder about its meaning, and Raoul, anticipating the answer to his questions, immediately states that it represents Muhammad. However, Tancred initially thinks that the statue could represent a pagan deity, Mars or Apollo, and then that it could be an effigy of Christ. When he realizes that the statue does not exhibit the familiar iconographic devices according to an antithetic logic, he concludes that it represents the first Antichrist. Then, it is only later that he associates the identity of the final enemy with Muhammad. Therefore, it seems clear that Tancred did not see a statue of the Prophet in the Dome of the Rock, but it rather refers to that of the Antichrist. This conclusion leads to the second question. Why is the statue, in this case, of the Antichrist located in the Dome of the Rock, the Temple of Solomon? This question implies an eschatological interpretation of the building. Indeed, according to passages of the scriptures regarding the end of time and their Christian exegesis, the rebuilding of the temple was expected to occur in connection with the appearance of the Antichrist before the parousia, the second coming of Christ. This tradition originated in response to Jewish messianic expectations connected to the liberation of Israel, its reappropriation of Jerusalem, and the restoration of the presence of God on the Temple Mount, was systematized in the Latin West in the famous Epistola de Orto et Tempore Antichristi, letter on the birth and the time of the Antichrist, written by Azzo of Montiende in the second half of the 9th century. In this text, which had a great diffusion and soon became the auctoritas on the subject, Azzo draws a biography of the Antichrist. He states that he will be born in Babylon, which here stands for the East, from a woman of the Jewish tribe of Dan and the devil, and he will be raised in Bethsaida and Chorazim, the two cities cursed by Christ in Matthew 11:21 and Luke 10:13. And then he will go to Jerusalem and murder all the Christians whom he will not succeed in converting, and will establish his see in the Holy Temple. Indeed, he will build the temple which Solomon dedicated to God, so far destroyed, and will restore it in its structure, and circumcise himself, and pretend to be the son of the omnipotent God. First, all the kings and princes will convert to him, and then all the other peoples. He will wander throughout the places which Jesus wandered through, but before doing that, he will destroy what the Lord had glorified. Then he will send his messengers and preachers all over the world. His preaching and power will spread from sea to sea, from east to west. When he goes to Jerusalem, he will say to the Jews, "I am the Christ who was promised to you. I came for your salvation, and I will gather you who are dispersed and defend you." Then they will flock to him. But the Antichrist will not appear unless all the reigns of the earth abandon the Roman Empire, to which they had submitted. Azzo then describes the appearance of the last world emperor, a king of the Franks, his fight against the Antichrist, and then the coming of Elijah and Enoch, and the final parousia of the Christ, his victory over his enemy, and the final judgment. It is relevant to note that Azzo describes the temple rebuilt by the Antichrist, and where he will establish himself to be adored, as the same temple which Solomon dedicated to God, so far destroyed. So, according to this prophecy and other texts that stem from it and that were very widespread in the 11th century, when the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem, they should have expected to find Mount Moriah abandoned. Instead, the Dome of the Rock stood there with its wonderful shape, recalling the familiar iconography of the Rotunda and Paleo-Christian shrines. This could seem to be the Temple of Solomon rebuilt by the Antichrist. Evidences of an eschatological interpretation of the Dome of the Rock in a Crusader context, so far overlooked by scholarly investigation, are found in some sources that contrast with the more accepted and widespread identification of the building as the ancient Temple of Solomon, which we have seen in the Qualiter Sita. The anonymous author of the Gesta Francorum, as early as 1101, notes that the famous Temple of the Lord, although magnificently constructed, was not the work of Solomon, nor the building reconstructed by Ezra. However, he says, it has four doors, as the first temple had. This doubt concerning the identification of the Dome of the Rock is complicated by the reasoning on its history that we find in the anonymous De Situ Urbis Jerusalem, the site of the city of Jerusalem. written around 1130, and some other texts that stem from it. The author, describing the history of Mount Moriah, says that this is the place where David settled the tabernacle and Solomon built the temple, but it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, then reconstructed by Ezra, once again destroyed by Antiochus and rebuilt by the Maccabees, and eventually razed by Titus and Vespasian. So, the present structure is the fourth temple, and some believe that it was built by Constantine and Helena, while others attribute it to Heraclius or Justinian. However, another tradition reports that this was a temple constructed by an Egyptian emir, Amiraldo, in honor of a lucky bear, which means the greatest god, ad honorem summi dei. This should be regarded as true since it is stated by an inscription found in the building. Moreover, before the arrivals of the Latins, there were no Greek inscriptions nor elements related to the Jewish cult. This text questions the official version of the history of the temple celebrated by Acardus d'Auez, first prior of the Templum Domini in 1112-1136. In the poem he wrote to Eudes for the dedication of the shrine, and this happened later in 1141, and entitled Tractatus Super Templum Domini, Treatise on the Temple of the Lord. Indeed, he tells that the structure that was visible in his time had uncertain origins. Maybe it had been rebuilt by Justinian, Helena, Constantine, or Heraclius, but whoever had constructed it, this was, is, and will be the holy temple of the Lord until the end of times. The solution chosen by Acardus to identify the shrine as the temple, whatever its Christian history might be, thus flattening out the past into an eternal present, finds a material objection in the epigraphic evidence pointed out by the anonymous of the De Situ Urbis Jerusalem. He refers, indeed, to the inscription found in the upper register of the decoration of the ambulatories of the Dome of the Rock, and that we have mentioned before. The statement about Islam as the final revelation, the negation of the Trinity, the status of Jesus as a prophet, which you can see in this detail, and that of Muhammad as the last apostle of God, is concluded by this statement. The dome was built by the servant of God, Abdallah, the Imam al-Ma'mun, commander of the faithful, in the year 270, that is from the Ishra, and so corresponds to the years 691-692. Actually, the name of al-Ma'mun, the seventh Abbasid caliph, who reigned from 813 to 833, was added later to substitute the mention of the Umayyad caliph Abd al-Malik, under whose patronage the building was completed in 691-92, as we have seen before. The anonymous writer perhaps did not notice this chronological inconsistency, but in any case, he was aware that the Arabic inscription contained the name of the builder, a Muslim ruler, and celebrated its dedication to Allahu Akbar, who is concealed under Al-Akibar. This element, along with the absence of traces of Jewish cult and Greek inscriptions, led him to set the temple, rebuilt for the fourth time, in a religious context that is antithetical to Christianity. This fact suggests that the Dome of the Rock should be attributed an eschatological meaning. Indeed, it seems to me that the choice of mentioning the takbir, the Arabic formula Allahu Akbar, rendered as Al-Akibar, rather than the simple Allah, and its translation as the greatest God instead of God is greater, aims to emphasize the difference between the God worshipped by Muslims and the God worshipped by Christians. This implies that the building is dedicated to the cult of a false god, and so recalls the abomination of desolation pronounced by Daniel 9:27, 11:31, and 12:11, and Jesus himself in the Gospel of Matthew 24:15-16, and expected to take place in the temple where the man of sin, the son of perdition, exalts himself against every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. And it's a quotation from the second letter to Thessalonians 2:3-4. This passage is also mentioned by Hudson as referring to the Antichrist, and in particular it is explained as his denial of the Trinity. This issue is central in Islam, since God is one and has no associates, and therefore Jesus is not the Son of God, is not endowed with a divine nature, and is only a prophet. This is the message proclaimed by the inscription in the Dome of the Rock, and it is the most relevant aspect of the Muslim religion that caused its perception by Christians as an anti-Trinitarian heresy. John of Damascus, who died in 749, one of the first fathers who attempted to explain the new religious phenomenon, included Islam among the 100 heresies of Christianity, which he discussed in his treatise on the Orthodox faith. Moreover, before commenting on some verses of the Quran where the divinity of Christ is denied and the oneness of God proclaimed, he states that the heresy of the Ishmaelites is the prodromos of the Antichrist. This term has a very specific meaning, and although it could be literally translated as forerunner, it does not just indicate a foreshadowing of the final deviation from the true faith, but the imminence of the final apostasy embodied by the Antichrist. Indeed, the prodromos, when used as a noun, has the specific meaning of someone who does something once he arrives to help accommodate or prepare for those following. And in particular, in the Sarmocastrensis, the military language, it describes one who is sent ahead by the commander to set up camp and prepare a spot for encampment. Prodromos also occurs in the Gospel of Matthew 11:10 in reference to John the Baptist: "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you," and alluding to Isaiah 43, "A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." The term soon became an epithet of John the Baptist in the Greek tradition, and qualified his mission as the last prophet who prepared the ground for the appearance of the Messiah, Jesus, whom he recognized and baptized. If we endow prodromos antichristou, the locution used by John of Damascus to define Islam, with the same meaning of John the Baptist's epithet, we can infer that in this text, Muhammad's doctrine is seen as the heresy that prepares for the coming of the Antichrist, who should be expected to appear shortly. Indeed, it is not by chance that the heresy of the Ishmaelites is placed by John of Damascus at the end of his list of deviant doctrines. In this perspective, the Dome of the Rock could be perceived as the Temple of Solomon rebuilt by the supporters of the Antichrist. This interpretation of the building is found in some Eastern Christian texts written on the aftermath of the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem, and originated from its Jewish messianic interpretation, witnessed by Jewish but also Muslim sources. In this text, the restoration of the temple is connected to Omar, who did not commission the building of the Dome of the Rock, but was credited to be the restorer of the sacredness of Mount Moriah through the interest he showed in the rock as soon as he entered Jerusalem. As far as Muslim tradition is concerned, we can mention the account made by Tabari and ascribed to the authority of Raja ibn Haywa, a contemporary of Abd al-Malik. According to him, the caliph went to the Temple Mount accompanied by Ka'b al-Ahbar, one of the first Jewish converts to Islam and an important transmitter of the Israelia Jewish exegetical and legendary traditions. Omar recited the Talbiyah, the pilgrim salutation upon arrival in Mecca, and went to the Mihrab Daoud, here the place of the Devir, where David had set the tabernacle. Asked the Muezzin to perform the Adhan, the call for prayer, and recited the Surah Sad of the Quran, which recalls the sin of David with Bathsheba and his repentance. Then he recited the incipit of the Surah Banu Israel 17:1 twice, thus granting upon Islamic tradition the sacredness of the place. When Omar asked Ka'ab about the Qibla, the direction of the prayer, he identified it with the rock. But the caliph disagreed, reminding him that they had been ordered by the prophet to venerate the Kaaba, and therefore decided to have it in front of the mosque he was meant to build on the southern side of the platform in order to have the rock behind the Qibla. He then went where the rock stood covered by rubbish, knelt and started cleaning it, asking his followers to do the same. Ka'ab then incited all those present to claim Allahu Akbar, and when he was asked why, he said that this was the fulfillment of a prophecy announced 500 years before, probably referring to Zechariah 2:14 or Zephaniah 3:14-15, according to which Omar was Al-Faruq, the Redeemer, come to cleanse Jerusalem buried in rubbish by the Romans, and according to another tradition transmitted by Rabia Shami, also reported by Tabari, to take vengeance of the children of Israel upon the Romans. This very messianic interpretation of Omar's cleansing of the rock is found, for instance, in a Jewish text datable to the mid-7th century and ascribed to a sage living at the time of the second Jewish revolt led by Bar Kokhba, the Nistarot Secrets of Rabbi Shimeon ben Yochai. It reports that Metatron, the angelic prince of the divine entity, revealed to Rabbi Shimeon the providential advent of the kingdom of Ishmael, which will deliver Israel from the wicked one, Edom Byzantium. God, indeed, will raise a prophet among the Ishmaelites and subdue the land for them and restore it with grandeur. Great and mighty will exist between them and the children of Esau, the Byzantines. The evidence of this statement, says Metatron, is found in Isaiah 21:7, where the pair of riders, one riding an ass and one riding a camel, is interpreted as prefiguring Muhammad and the Messiah. After the appearance of the prophet, the second king who will rise from Ishmael will be a friend of Israel, and this is Omar. He will repair the breaches and the breaches of the temple and shape Mount Moriah and make the wall of it a level plain. He will build for himself there a place for prayer upon the site of the foundation stone, as scripture says, and set your nest on the rock, Numbers 24:21. He will wage war with the children of Esau, and slaughter their troops and capture a large number of them, and eventually he will die in peace and with great honor. This exceptional document testifies the initial favor with which the Jews looked at Islamic conquest, the renewal of the hopes of being close to the promised liberation from persecution and tribulation, and the interpretation of the restoration of a place of prayer upon the rock on the Temple Mount as a starting point of the rebuilding of the temple that will be completed by the Messiah. Another evidence of the centrality of Omar's recovery of the rock and its eschatological interpretation is also found in the Chronographia by Theophanes Byzantinus, who wrote in the 9th century, relying on the Syriac chronicle of Theophilus of Edessa, 8th century. He writes that when Omar entered the holy city, he sought out the temple of the Jews, the one built by Solomon, that he might make it a place of worship for his own blasphemous religion. Seeing this, Sophronius, the patriarch of Jerusalem, said, "Verily, this is the abomination of desolation standing in a holy place, as has been spoken through the prophet Daniel." And with many tears, the defender of pity bewailed the Christian people. Abomination of desolation clearly alludes to the restoration of the Jewish temple and the cult of a false god to be established in it. And Theophanes goes further when he narrates that some years later, in 643, Omar started to build the temple, Naos, at Jerusalem, but the structure would not stand and kept falling down. So the Jews suggested removing the cross from above the church of the Mount of Olives, and when it was done, the building stood. For this reason, Christ's enemies took down many crosses. This sentence describes Muslims and Jews as enemies of Christ and associates them with the rebuilding of the temple. The same association is previously found in the Chronographia when Theophanes, drawing a biography of Muhammad, recounts that at the beginning he had been recognized by the Jews as the Messiah. Moreover, he identifies Muhammad as the religious and political leader of the Saracens and Omar as his military chief, and locates the conquests of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt during the lifetime of the prophet, who instead died in 632. So, in this chronological frame, the temple is rebuilt while Muhammad, the pseudo-prophet recognized as the Messiah by the Jews, is still alive. Theophanes does not explicitly state that Muhammad is the Antichrist, but this issue, related to our third question, is developed by Hugo Fleury in the second recension of his Chronicon, finished in 1109, which was based on the Latin translation of Theophanes' Chronographia, made by Anastasius the Librarian in the 9th century. In his biography of Muhammad, Hugh narrates that he was a descendant of Ishmael, who, when he was young, was engaged in trade. Through traveling, he had the opportunity to learn the scriptures from Christians and Jews, and also to learn magic. When he went to the rich province of Chorasanium, he succeeded in seducing its sovereign, the widow Khadija, and making her believe that he was the Messiah expected by the Jews. Then the Jews, together with the Saracens, accepted his claim, and he proceeded to invent for them a new religion, a new religious law, based on testimonies found in the Old and the New Testaments. Muhammad married the lady and became powerful, took command of the province, and through his followers he attacked and conquered large territories belonging to the Byzantine Empire. Following these auspicious events, Muhammad began to suffer from epileptic fits, and to reassure his wife troubled by these events, he told her that it was the effect of the splendor of the Archangel Gabriel, who often appeared to him, and both the lady and his followers believed his claim. The story ends here and seems to be incomplete, but it is sufficient to see how Hugh, has constructed Muhammad's biography according to that of the Antichrist drawn by Adsu. The Antichrist will come from the tribe of Dan, which was regarded as idolatrous since it worshipped Belial. And Muhammad is set in an idolatrous context as well. The Antichrist will be born in the East and will be educated in Khorasim, one of the two cities maledicted by Christ. And Muhammad was born in Arabia, considered as belonging to Asia, since Africa ended at the western shore of the Nile, and received his sentimental education in Khorasania, a word that has several variants in manuscripts and echoes the name of the biblical city. The Antichrist will learn magic and perform miracles, and Muhammad too learned magic and used his skills to marry the widow and gain power. The Antichrist will proclaim to be the Messiah and will be recognized as such by the Jews, as happened to Muhammad. The Antichrist will subjugate the kings of the earth and deprive the empire of vast territories, as Muhammad did through the action of his lieutenants. Among these lieutenants, we have seen that Omar had great relevance as the right-hand man of Muhammad and was credited as having rebuilt the Temple of Solomon. We could expect, as the end of the story, that the statue of Muhammad, the Antichrist, could be raised in the temple to be adored by his followers, Saracens and Jews. At this point, we can conclude that if from an eschatological perspective, the Dome of the Rock was considered to be the Temple of Solomon rebuilt by Muslims and Jews in honor of the false Messiah, namely the Antichrist, who in turn was identified as Muhammad, it was to be expected that the statue of the prophet could be found there. Thus, Raoul's text materializes this expectation. However, in his description of the finding and the destruction of the statue, he states that Muhammad is the first Antichrist, after whom another one will come. What is the meaning of this? We can find an answer in the call for crusade pronounced by Pope Urban II at the Council of Clermont in 1095, according to the text transmitted by Guibert de Nogent in his Gesta Dei per Francos, God's Deeds Through the Franks, completed in 1121. In this text, after recalling the holiness of the Holy Land, Jerusalem, and in particular the Holy Sepulchre, the Pope incites the audience to cleanse the sanctuaries of the pollution operated by the Gentiles, and here that means the Muslims. Following the examples of the Maccabees, the apostles, and the martyrs, the Christian soldiers are encouraged to wage a just war, the reward for which is martyrdom and eternal glory. Moreover, they have to consider that Jerusalem has to be recovered by Christians since the Antichrist is approaching. According to Daniel and Jerome, he will sit in the temple of Jerusalem and will be adored as a god, and will then defeat the kings of Egypt, Africa, and Ethiopia for the Christian faith. This cannot happen if Christianity is not established where paganism, and here Judaism and Islam, is now spread. So the Christians, with the cooperation of God, have to fulfill the prophecy about the end of the rule of the Gentiles over the Holy Land. The end of time is near, and Christianity should be renewed in those regions before the coming of the Antichrist, so that he who is there to occupy the throne of the kingdom shall find some support of the faith to fight against him. In light of this argumentation, Raoul's text clearly reveals its meaning. Tancred finds and destroys the statue of Muhammad, the first Antichrist, for whom the temple had been reconstructed in the Dome of the Rock, the building that proclaims the triumph of Islam and Judaism from their perspective, as we have seen in the previous sources. By doing so, he restores Christian control over Jerusalem and prepares the terrain for the final battle against the second Antichrist who is coming. In this context, the eschatological meaning of the Dome of the Rock at the dawn of the Crusade appears in its fullness. Indeed, Raoul's text constitutes extraordinary evidence of the vitality of a tradition concerning the eschatological role of Islam that developed from the Jewish and Christian reaction to the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem and the recovery of the sacredness of Mount Moriah. This tradition, intertwined with the identification of Muslim power as the last reign and Muhammad as the Antichrist, reflourished when the urgency of freeing the Holy Land imposed itself on Western Christians in the 11th century. When, after the Crusader conquest of Jerusalem, the expectations about the end were not fulfilled, the Latin Kingdom became a stable reality and pilgrimage and liturgy reshaped the sacred topography of the city according to the biblical past, the Dome of the Rock was integrated into this landscape and its Islamic past and eschatological meaning were obliterated. However, by attentively reading the sources and comparing them, we can still find traces of this attitude towards the building. These traces allow us to understand how the statue of Muhammad, reported to be located in the Dome of the Rock in texts written after the First Crusade, constitutes the crystallization of eschatological expectations concerning the coming of the Antichrist in Jerusalem. Thank you.